Well, I'm Erhard Gerstenberger from Germany, and we are going to talk in four sessions about Latin American spirituality in relation to the Old Testament Psalms. You may come and listen to all these presentations, but each of them also is in a closed unit in itself. So you don't need to worry that you stay open-ended and lost with one individual session. I was thinking to say a few things in advance. One, I need to tell you, well, it was not the end yet of the...
Just finished.
We were waiting for you. And we thought when some people drifted in that this was the end of the crowd which was coming, but there came more. You are all welcome here, and let me tell you again how happy I am to be with you tonight. With this subject also, which tries to unite, really, several aspects of psalmody and general life. For one thing, I want to speak about Old Testament Psalms with you and discover some of them also. And I want to, secondly, I want to explain and give to you some of my experiences in Brazil, where I lived for more than 7 years altogether, with psalm singing and liturgical efforts and liturgical modes, worshipping. And thirdly, and that might be quite interesting and is most important for me, well, you may take a seat here. There's enough room for all of us.
I think you're better prepared than over there.
That's good. Thirdly, I would like to solicit your collaboration in these sessions. I sort of hate to talk alone during one full hour each time. I would love your collaboration, and I will immediately tell you how you may cooperate. As you noticed before, we want to learn something about psalm singing, about how psalm singing and psalmody fits into each particular life situation of all these cultural different places which I mentioned, the Old Testament, Brazil, and United States today. I would like to ask you to think about the possibility to write your own psalms during the course work we are doing here, to write your own psalms, your United States American psalms, let's say that. And you will soon find out how it might work. I have tried this before with students and pastors, and it always was a surprise to us that we as people, as general, as people of God, as members of some community, are able to make our own psalms. Certainly some of you would be alarmed about the idea, say, we are no poets, we are not no biblical writers, we can't do it. Yes, you can. And if we talk only 1 hour now, you will see how you can do it. About my person, I don't need to say very much, I guess, but one thing is important, which you asked before. My experience from the Brazilian churches and the Brazilian way of making and singing songs comes from seven years of stay down there in the south of Brazil. I was a teacher of Old Testament at the Lutheran Seminary in São Leopoldo, which is in the southernmost state of Brazil, which is called Rio Grande do Sul. Very close to the border of Uruguay and of Argentina. And there I taught for 6 years. Here's one more chair left, and there's one more. And there I taught for about 6 years at one stretch, and then subsequently for lesser time. And my last visit there was in April 1989, a few months ago. when I heard for the first time about Holden Village, and which triggered my letter to come here to apply for a place here. And it, I'm very glad that it worked out this way. Well, I guess I want to give you some more ideas of what we are going to do under this subject. And to make it more graphically visible, I want to put it onto the board, what I want to do. We want to talk once about the Psalms in the Old Testament. Secondly, about the Psalms principally in Brazil, the new songs, and the new songs which have come up in, by the thousands, as you already heard by our Middle American friends, Guilherme. In Brazilian language, it would be Guilherme. Guilherme. And Jesse, is your colleague is Jesse. And Bill. And third, we want to talk about the importance of the Psalms today. And at this point, you are asked to collaborate and provide and make your own texts. Well, the four sessions are divided, you may see it on the board, are divided somewhat so that we don't want to repeat ourselves every time. Today the emphasis is on lament and joy. That means we are talking about the large group of psalms which have something to complain, to lament about. And you will see what this means. But let me get back to give you a few general ideas about the background, the Brazilian background first, which I'm talking about. I will start with the Brazilian scene, with the Brazilian setting. When we came to Brazil in 1975, we lived in Rio de Janeiro first for 3 months to learn the language there, because after 3 months I had to teach in Portuguese language and I didn't know a bit about it when I got there. So we had a very intensive course. My wife, who is next doors, and two little children, they couldn't speak very well at all. They were left alone, and we took courses 8 hours a day. And then we were pretty much fit to talk a little, you know. And when I started to teach really in São Leopoldo, down in the south, I was able to communicate a little, and the students helped me to get further on, and that way I learned more about the language. During the days in Rio de Janeiro, we had intensive contact with liberation theologians of the Catholic Church, because we were actually attending a Roman Catholic Institute of acculturation, it's called, acculturation, something like that. The word exists in English too, doesn't it? It's a Portuguese word. And one day, this is the thing I want to talk, to tell you. One of the first Sundays we were there in Rio, Padre Fernando took us to one of the favelas of Rio. You probably know what a favela is, do you? Not everybody knows. The favelas are something like settlements which you would call slum dwellings, or worse than slum dwellings, where people from the countryside flock into the cities to find work, to find bread, and to sustain themselves, because they are expelled from their lands. You know, there's a whole big story about expulsion from the lands in Latin America, which is a terrible story. It's the big landowners try to get all the land possible and for their own use, and expel the smaller farmers and the farmhands which live there. And so they flock into the cities, many of them, millions of them, flock into the cities. And then they try to find housing there. There is no housing. At least they cannot pay any the housing there. So they settle down on land which is nobody's land, among at the side of railroad tracks, or under bridges, or at steep hills, or in swampy areas where nobody claims right of private property. And so this Padre Fernando took us into the first favela which I had seen from the inside, a very large favela, and Rio de Janeiro abounds in favelas. Just like Sao Paulo, where I visited this year in April, abounds in favelas. There are hundreds of them, any size, from 100 inhabitants to 100,000 inhabitants. Crammed together in very small little shacks, you would say, built from cardboard or little wood planks or iron pieces and so on. So this was, I had a little bit, I was afraid to go into the favela, but with the Catholic priest you may go because he is known there. As a tourist you may never go into a favela because you might not get out again, at least not undamaged. So we went into the favela and we saw all the misery which is there, all the children playing in the mud, you know, the pigs on the road, which there is no road, there's only a muddy path where the stinky waters run downhill, and so on. And we saw the precarious conditions of these people who live there. And it was a sight which I would really want everybody to know. But we came up a little bit in the favela and we were stared at, of course, by all the people who met us. We get a little bit high up and there was a rather reasonable house. This was the community center of the Catholic community. And the priest was going to hold, to celebrate Mass there that Sunday. That's where we went with him. And that's the point I was going to make. You cannot imagine how these people who gathered there were open to us, children and adults alike. They embraced us. Everybody embraces everybody to greet them. In Latin America, that's a beautiful custom. We have almost adopted it. We are prone to embrace people when we meet them now, since we have been living there. And everybody said hello to us and took it very natural that we were participating in the service, in the Mass. And what we witnessed was a Mass of singing, of liturgy, of praise to the Lord. I've never experienced such a strong feeling of astonishment that poor people who barely can subsist from day to day, who really do not know what to eat the next day, and whether they may keep an employment which they have picked up perhaps for a few days. That people who are plagued by sickness and hunger and illiteracy and every kind of disease which you may imagine, also crime and drugs, which are in the favelas. People plagued like Job, I would say, in the Bible, plagued every day and barely can make a living. One lady told us how her husband is ailing away in her home. He couldn't attend the Mass, and she was talking about her husband who has had tuberculosis and was lying there in one of these mud shacks, you know, muddy with a muddy floor and so on. How they sang, how they celebrated the Mass. You cannot imagine what kind of impression it was. My words are too weak to communicate this experience to you, but I want to tell it anyway. They started out half an hour before the Mass. They had a very tiny little record player there, and they put on a little record, and this was the record for the day. A commission of the Catholic Church in Brazil made up records with new songs and liturgical pieces to learn, for them to learn during for the Mass. And they sang away, learning this, everybody, young and old, half an hour, and they repeated it, and it was live, you know, almost live as you experienced it yesterday in our service with our friends there. You had a little feeling of Latin America was there yesterday when you attended, you know, during the worship service. They were really living living the music and learning the music. And then they sat down, and the priest celebrated the mass, and they repeated everything which was on the little record. And that was my first and strongest impression which I have had of American poor people singing praises, singing also laments, breaking out in this incredible joy that the Lord is there and helping them and being there. The kingdom of God is there. And this is, I think, for me, unforgettable. You may ask now how it comes that these people sing, and how it comes that they make new music, that they sing new psalms. And I consider psalms every song, every prayer which is directed to God is, for me, it's a psalm. I am not putting up limits, narrow limits for this category of song. You know, they need not be exactly in the fashion of the Old Testament psalms. The Old Testament psalms are verified in themselves as well. There's no uniformity to the Old Testament. We will talk about this in a moment. How does it come that they like to sing, and that they created a whole new generation of church songs, of sacred songs, of liturgy in Latin America, and especially also in Brazil? You have always in I want you to keep in mind the masses and the songs which you heard from our group, which is fortunately among us. I kept thinking a great deal about this problem, because I know so well that misery and suffering not always produces psalms and songs and praise and liturgies. You know, I've met enough people in my life who were utterly depressed, downtrodden by their sufferings, and who wouldn't dare to sing, and wouldn't come into their mind to take part, and the misery, the need closed their mouth and did not open it to communal life and to psalmody. In fact, I have seen these people also in Brazil. Once I was traveling, you know, in 85, I was traveling towards the center of Brazil for the first time to the Mato Grosso, a state which is called Mato Grosso, the big forest, or the gross, the thick forest, perhaps. And I remember very well how I changed buses. I had to go on this long journey, 800 kilometers or 600 miles. For a European, it's very terribly far, you know. I flew a good bit to go get into the center, and then I took the bus. And, you know, a very small and tiny and slim and meager and man was sort of following my steps, accompanying me to the bill counter, and when I bought my ticket and so on. And I thought, my goodness, why is he doing that? And he was always looking at me, and he was sort of like a dog following my steps, you know. And I asked him, and he, in a very almost unrecognizable Portuguese, he told me that he was a land a worker, farmhand, working on a big farm and returning home for a vacation. And I tried to ask him about the conditions of work there, and he wouldn't say a thing about it. He would always say, oh yes, and so on, yes, you know. And he was the type of person who was utterly depersonalized, I felt. He wouldn't dare to give his own opinion. He was always looking for some direction. He was always bowing down and not to attract perhaps the anger or the opposition of somebody. And that's the type of person you find also in Latin America. Totally people who have no person anymore, who don't dare to be a person, to say I want or I am. They are utterly depersonalized, and some Brazilian writers and analysts have described this state of a human being as as a deshuman state of existence, you know. There's something missing in their lives, the self-respect and the will to assert oneself and to be to be a person. They receive a minimum, below minimum wage, and the minimum wage, I will tell you later, is not worth living by. It's only to starve. It's at the moment in April it was $36 a month for a full day's and full month job, minimum wage, and 50% of the Brazilian population are earning only a minimum wage, and sometimes several people have to live on one wage. In 1970 or 75, it was still $100 worth this minimum wage. And now it shrank to $36 per month. Can you imagine? The prices are a little bit lower than here, but for $36 a month, you cannot buy the most essential means of subsistence, rice and black beans. You cannot buy them to last you 1 month for one person. And you have to work at least 2 days to buy 1 kilo of meat. 2 days. So meat is out of the question. You cannot, as a poor person, you cannot eat meat. Certainly not. And so on. Well, how does it occur that people in this condition are able to sing? That's our question. I wonder whether you would know an answer to that. I don't. I really don't. I would say, for me, it's one of the miracles of God's Spirit. I cannot help. I have no explanation for it. And since I know that you cannot simply voice your complaint, even in such a situation, and you lament, I must say that these people are not living by their endeavor, by their wish to complain. No, they live from the presence of God. They are thankful. That's why in our title today, the word joy or thankfulness must not must be there. You know, you cannot speak only about complaining. There's much of lament in their songs. Yes, that's true. But the real fountain of their singing is not the complaining. The wish to complain or to lament their fate. I think I have learned this, and now I switch to Germany for a second. When I came back to Germany in an interval, on a furlough in 79, I was so overwhelmed by the German way of complaining and lamenting in their well-being, you know. It was unbelievable. It almost struck me. It almost killed me to hear people complain, for instance, that the inflation in Germany was terrible. It was about 4 or 5% a year. And we came back from a country which had, at that time, 250% of inflation per year, you know. I couldn't believe it. Or people of any age who were eager to have something to complain about, and they told you immediately all their story of their ailments. I know that there are such things, that everybody is suffering something, and there is reason also to say it to your neighbor, of course. But if this is the only motivation for talking, and you stay in this vicious circle and you complain, and the other one reinforces your complaints, you know, and your laments. He has a bigger gall or kidney stone than you have. I have one too, you know. I wonder whether anybody has a bigger one than I. No? And I talk about this too, certainly, at times. But in Germany, it seemed to me that the whole motivation, the whole reason to be, was complaining about these things. And in reality, there was nothing to complain, because they all had a very safe and very very good living. And that's probably the problem of people in well-situated societies, you know, which are so abundant and affluent like the German, and perhaps also a little bit the United States. I don't want to I don't want to denounce you, you know. I rather denounce my own folks, but it's rather bad. You know, a complaint and in as such, the ailments or the little things which we do suffer. Of course, do we suffer? And there are also serious things to lament about. But lament as such cannot be and must not be, theologically speaking, speaking in a Christian way, must not be our sole motivation to sing a song. And this is what you can learn in Brazil. The joy of liberation is the motivating force. These poor people there in the favela, they sing, "We are liberated. God is with us. We discovered that we are human beings and that God is with us. What a joy. Now we can come up with our lament." That's about the order of things. Well, if I continue this way, I think I will take up too much time. I wanted to go back for a second to the Old Testament. What's the picture there? And I brought with me, I took from the other room some Bibles. I don't know whether you have Bibles or whether we should stay with one here at the desk. And I'll read briefly a few texts. I want to give some examples also, you know, of that which I mean. This subject alone, Old Testament complaints and praise and joy, would fill a whole seminar, perhaps, and I have to limit myself very much to give you an idea what happened in the Old Testament times. Fact is that we have in the Old Testament Psalter a large number of psalms which do contain the elements of lament. I don't know whether you already recognize this reading the Bible. Famous lament, "From the depth of the abyss I cry to thee," Psalm 130, you know. "Lord, hear my voice," or something. I'm translating now freely from the German. "Aus der Tiefe, Herr, schreie ich, Herr, zu dir. Herr, höre meine Bitte." Something like that, you know. Psalm 130. Or Psalm 69. "I'm stuck in the mud until my neck." And I'm getting ever deeper into the mud. "Please pull me out, Lord." Something like that. And I give you two more examples. Perhaps I will limit myself to this. Psalms which complain, which lament in the Old Testament. And then we ask, what's happening there? What's happening? The one is the famous Psalm 22, which starts, my God, why hast thou me forsaken," or something like that. I'll read it to you, so I won't miss the English text and sin against the English text, you know. my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Why art thou so far from helping me, from the words of my groaning? O my God, I cry by day, but thou dost not answer, and by night, but find no rest." Then there is another section which I skip because it has another tone to it, confidence. I want to hear read only the lamenting sections now. "But I am a worm and no man, scorned by men and despised by the people. All who see me mock at me. They make mouths at me. They wag their heads." Wag their heads, that's a certain gesture of depreciation, you know, and of perhaps with demonic connotations. They wag their heads. "He committed his cause to the Lord. Let him deliver him. Let him rescue him, for he delights in him." Then there's another segment of confidence, we'll talk about next time. And then, "Many bulls encompass me, strong bulls of Bashan surround me. They open wide their mouth at me like a ravening and roaring lion." And then, I'm poured out like water, and all my bones are out of joint. My heart is like wax. It is melted within my breast. My strength is dried up like a potsherd, and my tongue cleaves to my jaws. Thou dost lay me in the dust of death. Yea, dogs are round about me. A company of evildoers encircle me. They have pierced my hands and my feet. I can count all my bones. They stare and gloat over me. They divide my garments among them, and for my raiment they cast lots. These words are also known from the New Testament because they are applied to Jesus, you know. And one more example, and then I will try to explain a little what happens in these laments. The other one is 38. Verses 1 to 8. 38, 1 to 8. O Lord, rebuke me not in thy anger, nor chasten me in thy wrath. For thy arrows have sunk into me, and thy hand has come down on me. There is no soundness in my flesh because of thy indignation. There is no health in my bones because of my sin. For my iniquities have gone over my head. They weigh like a burden too heavy for me. My wounds grow foul and fester because of my foolishness. I am utterly bowed down and prostrate. All the day I go about mourning, for my loins are filled with burning, and there is no soundness in my flesh. I am utterly spent and crushed. I groan because of the tumult of my heart. Suffice it for this time, for the time being. What is happening? What can we make out of these words of lament in the Old Testament times? I think you realize that there is one group of affirmations which speak something about the sickness of the body. You know, the wounds, the flesh, the bone, the tongue, and the signs of fever, perhaps, which you feel, tongue like potsherds and saying, dry the mouth and dried up, my flesh is falling away. Wounds and sickness are behind these images of complaint, of lament. I guess, therefore, that these psalms used to be prayed and in service, in a small service, for the sick, by people who really were sick, who had no chance to survive, who cast their lot with the Lord in the ultimate instance, who had perhaps tried to get all kinds of remedies, which somebody knew, grandma or grandfather or the wise man or the medicine man, what have you, I don't know who existed, or the prophet for that matter. They had tried everything, no result, no betterment, so they went to the service, they went to order or to have a worship service, a prayer service for the sick. In some churches it's held up to this day, I know it. I have in Brazil witnessed services for the sick, not only by Pentecostal people who do it to a large extent, you know, are famous for their healings down there. I don't know how it's here. But it's part of our worship life, or it was part of the Old Testament worship life, to take care of the sick in prayer services. And these psalms then are part of this service for a sick man, and he had to recite. But this is not sufficient. The second aspect, you notice that there are images of surrounding enemies, sometimes even in animal shapes, like bulls and dogs and lions and shackles and everything find mentioned in the Psalms. And this is the other side of Old Testament need and danger and threat to the life of a person, that he feels endangered by those people who cause the sickness. We have to think back. We cannot presuppose our knowledge of bacteria and reasons or causes for sickness. Antique people always believed, up to our own times, until the last century, and sometimes even up to our day, that behind every misfortune and ailment which befalls me. There must be some evil mind, some evil monger, some evil doer. And I tell you this because it's here in the Psalms. I don't think we can lead with it, but we have to think of it. And my last presentation will focus on this problem, which I think is an essential problem for the Psalms, because we misunderstand the Psalms when we try to translate this aspect into our times. We get into all kinds of very, very bad habits, you know, if we translate the enemy image of the Psalms into our times. We have to speak about this later. I just put up the warning signal. But here they are, these two aspects, ailment of the body and persecution and evil mongering of mischievous minds, whoever they might be. They may be demons, they may be persons, they may be even God himself. Why hast thou forsaken me? Here the psalmist is really thinking that God is the cause of his affliction. So, this was a small little, a little piece of the reality of the Old Testament times. And now, perhaps a few more minutes back to, we have so little time left, that I really want to ask you now, rather for questions and comments, and perhaps develop a little further. I don't want to exclude you from our ongoing talk and study here. We are together going into this matter of psalmody. What's your reaction? What's your comments? Yes?
Yeah, you mentioned the difference between the people in the favela versus the, I guess, the rural person.
Yes.
One thought, maybe the favela people have a kind of a community behind them, whereas this rural person is isolated, individual, beaten down, had no community to go.
That may be a good observation, although there are many rural communities. I think you talked about, Guillermo, you talked about rural communities. They are very strong, the grassroots or base communities in the interior. And so you see the ambivalence of your comment. There may be, but it may be the case that he was isolated. Although there are always people around, but they don't get together. They lead their atomized lives under heavy pressure, and everybody takes care of only of himself. And then it happens that they are non-liberated.
Well, I appreciate the contrast you made between the worship in the favela and the joy that could be expressed there and the complaints of the Germans. And
yes.
I've noticed that very strongly in our own community, which is Valparaiso, Indiana, where we're members of an ELCA congregation, where, you know, when the prayer requests come at the beginning of the service, everyone is sick, or, you know, someone has just died, or worried about so-and-so who's facing an operation, which I appreciate also. But then there's a small black congregation that worships out of the African-American tradition in the community also. And I know this also from the black church in Chicago, where worship begins. I mean, the prayer requests come, and it's, you know, I thank God for bringing me through such and such. You know, or we thank God that sickness isn't getting us down in spirit. It was a very thankful approach to things, which is a real contrast, because the people have a much harder life also than these, you know, the middle-class Lutherans that were worshiping. I mean, typically the prayer, you know, a very typical prayer here in Chicago Black Church anyway is, you know, I thank you for getting me up this morning. I thank you for bringing me through the night. Just a real spirit of that sort. So.
Please.
The government of Brazil is pretty corrupt. When you read about Brasilia, all the money they borrowed from the United States, they haven't been able to pay any of it back. Mm-hmm. And these settlements outside of this town, I guess, of Brasilia, people living in shacks and people living in the town have very high incomes. What it seems to me we're talking about a lot of theology here, but what about the economics down there?
Mm-hmm.
Is there something that could be done to correct that?
The Brazilian society is a human society as other societies which I know, German, United States society, and others. And I trust that any society can be corrupt. The Brazilian is very corrupt society. I don't think that this is the only reason for poverty. It's one reason for poverty. One great big other reason is the dependency, the continuing dependence of the economy, of Brazilian economy, on the economies and the capital of the so-called developed nations, which are United States, Japan, and Europe. And I could give a whole seminar on this topic. I must limit myself to this, to these observations. I do not want to exclude your concern. Brazilian society is corrupt to an amazing degree and to an alarming degree, but outward domination of economy and capital and banking systems is the other big reason for poverty. The gap between rich and poor in Latin America and in Brazil is enormously great. If the minimum wage is, say, one, you know, if you count it as one, as unit one, then the top people in Brazil are earning 100,000 or 1,000,000. You know, you have to multiply the earnings of the rich ones by 100,000 or 1,000,000. To get to the top layers of society. That's a very thin layer, as everywhere in the Latin American countries, a very thin layer of about 2 to 5% of the population, which is really unbelievable rich. It is said, and I think with reason, that the accounts, the foreign accounts, which this layer holds in foreign lands in the exterior would equal, at least equal, the Brazilian debt of $120 billion. That's a story all by itself. We may talk about this privately, perhaps. I don't want to spend all the time on this issue, but it's a very important issue. It's a very important issue, the economic situation. Yes?
Did I hear you say that when you were talking about the sounds up there? I guess my question is, my experience has been that a lot of people, when they have something serious, end up turning to the hymnal and using that as sounds. And that seems to be very, very, very therapeutic.
Yes, here in the United States, or what are you referring to? People?
Yeah, I
see.
Local parish.
Local parish. I think that's beautiful.
And for some reason, they go back to the chorales.
That's beautiful. You know, I'm very interested in all this kind of information also, which I get from you, because I think that this psalmody has very ancient roots. I read a book once by an English philologist named Bowra. The title is Primitive Song, and he believes that in an ancient pre-literary time, when the ancient hunters of 100,000 years ago moved through Europe and Africa, whatever have you there, in these regions where the human race first settled, they already started to learn about the power of the sung word, of the word sung in praise and plea to God and in lament to God. He believes that, and I think he's right. And this goes back to a very, very old human tradition, that people like to sing and to have their ceremonials as in times of need and in times of joy and in times of victory. And in fact, those people on our earth which still remain in a what we call live under Stone Age conditions, they gave the material to this book. You know, he collected it collected songs all over the world, from Australia to the Eskimos, to demonstrate it, that they have poems, poetry, liturgies, a powerful word. That means the human race discovered very early that the sung word is a power in itself. I ask you, ladies and gentlemen, what happened to this discovery, age-old discovery in our times? I see that many young people are glued to the television set, and they don't learn anymore to use and to formulate words and to use the power of naturally. that's a Freudian mistake, I guess, of word, of language, you know, which comes up to his peak in liturgy, in ritual. And another example, I mean, our age is to an alarming degree losing this discovery, this insight that it's healing, that the sung word, it has a healing power.
But the other side is, we have finally taken the funeral back to the church, and we sing hymns, and people will invariably remark how much they appreciated singing anywhere from Jesus Loves Me to A Mighty Fortress. You've got both ends of the gamut.
Yes.
How much those hymns meant to them at that time.
Yes, I agree. And I see that developments are underway in our civilization, that at least there are big changes taking place with the sung word. My boys, they learn all kinds of songs by rock groups, you know. And astonishingly enough, I felt, that's how I feel, that some rock groups have quite decent or interesting or deep-reaching texts concerned with life and death and love and hate and so on. I was really surprised when I learned this from my boys, what they are singing, you know, what they are singing. they memorize this. That's an encouraging sign. But the power of the sung word, I think, is partially succumbing to television culture. Please.
Maybe one of the reasons you talked about watching television, I think our life has become too easy. There's not the hard moments, whether it's the Appalachian digging the potatoes out of the ground, or the black man in slavery.
Mm-hmm.
There aren't those hard moments that give rise to those songs of hope, as there was.
Yes. Yes, I guess so. Our easy living is dangerous living, you know. Easy life is a dangerous life, I think. I want to give you some examples of Brazilian lament still, you know. I have three picked out here, translated into English. I'll give that, but there may be some more, some urgent comments or questions still.
There's one back there.
Yes.
I'm envious of the Latin American ability to sing praise in the midst of the laments that
yes.
could possibly be saying more of.
Mm-hmm.
I wish that we could do more of that, and I'm wondering, my first impression is that, if possible, it's cultural as opposed to theological reasons. But then I think about it more, it has to be that interplay that goes back and forth.
Yes.
And I explain a lot of my tradition, being a Scandinavian, upper Europeans, oftentimes tend to be very hush-hush about the pain, and very individualistic, and
yes.
very private. And I wonder if fluency doesn't add another shell to that, and so we cannot
yes.
communally express our joy because we can't admit to our pain.
I'm grateful for that remark also. You know, I know it from my own experience, how cultural influences are there to open mouth or to shut mouth, you know. In Europe, we travel from the south, from the Italian peninsula to the north, and the farther north you get, the more closed the mouths are. And when we come to Sweden, we came to Sweden some years ago, and we were astonished how shut up they were. And and I couldn't believe it that they the Swedes, I don't want to offend anybody here, nor any grand parents of your Swedish forebears. But I was astonished to watch television, and there was not the slightest smile on the screen by the one who spoke the news, or some stern and. This even astonished us Germans, who are quite closed up too, you know. And the habit to embrace people is not German, you know, I can tell you that. Really not. I'm grateful, but you already said a very good thing, you know. You should take into account the cultural dimensions of everything. I'm here to tell you that these three things, Old Testament, Brazil, and our situation here today, are not congruent, are not identical. There are so many things which make peculiarities in each situation, and we cannot simply never translate one thing which we find good in one culture to another culture. It's not possible. This is my life as an exegete of the Old Testament to experience it. But we have, and this is my positive statement, we have to see other cultures, to appreciate them, to learn them about them, to see them in their functioning as a whole, and then go back to our cultures and see how we are functioning and what we can do with our means. Perhaps it's not the joy of embracing and of opening and singing on the streets. Perhaps it's something else which we can do instead. You know, that's the point. And that's where I want to enter again with my plea. Please collaborate here with your own psalm poetry. I want to continue on that suggestion, and I'm not sure when we have to stop. Shortly. Unfortunately. I like you participating. This is the best thing of all this kind of session here. Let's see how you can go about it. Please, after what you heard today and after all your own reflections on the subject already, go, if you have 10 minutes or 15 minutes for yourself, try to write a lament, a serious one, you know, with this warning in mind that lament cannot be all of it. But try to focus on lament. Try to take an instant or an event or something which bothers you, an event or a situation you are concerned about in your experience, and write a few lines of lamenting to God over this thing. This is not a must, of course, but I invite you to do that. And with all the anonymity which there may be, put the thing here next time, or leave it at our house there, where both of us live, number 6, Shelley, somewhere. I will go through it and perhaps read one or the other thing. The name, the author, or the who did it is not important, I think. You should not be afraid to be identified. You only are asked to write down a lament, a few lines of lament, which, of course, is incomplete. There should be other things, but you could already formulate it with this in mind, that it is only a part of a psalm, you know? Lift your voice in lamentation for the next time. And then we'll see what happened, and I will feed it back to you a little bit of it, or all of it. I don't know how much will come in of lament Wednesday, and we'll see. And I think if we have to close now, I will read you a few examples of lament of my Brazilian home. You know, I feel at home there. I feel at home in the United States also, most of all in on the Navajo Reservation, where I worked a little while as a missionary among the Navajos, as a Presbyterian missionary. There was no Lutheran congregation I could go to. So I posed as a Presbyterian. And, I'm a mixed breed anyway. I grew up in a Presbyterian part of our country. I'm teaching at the Lutheran University, if that is a comfort to you, teaching at the oldest Lutheran university. One lament of Brazil reads like this: "Hear us, our God. You are the strength of the weak and the lowly. Hear our clamor, which is burning our intestines. We are the miserable of the earth. That's the way they call us. It is hard to live only by your two hands when a gang of exploiters is after you. We live in shacks of dirt and boards. When it rains, our children weep. Cold weather bites into our bones. We have three chairs to sleep on, instead of beds, you know. Our household is a tiny compartment. Our children grow up naked, without and within. They are the ones who steal food on the marketplace. Everyone condemns us and looks at us with disgust. And we have to swallow our black hatred in order not to explode. We eat rice and beans if we can. We all eat from one plate until the dish is finished. We work 2 hours away from house. From home, we have to rise at 4 in the morning. They keep us like starved dogs. Our big-bellied bosses do not consider us humans. We already start to think like them. We come to the point to lose all hope. Stark language, isn't it? And concrete language. And if you can stand a shorter piece of lament. My God, my God, why did you abandon me? I am a caricature of a man, despised by everyone. They make fun of me in their papers. Their armored cars close in on me. They point their machine guns at me, and I am surrounded by wire, by electric fences. Every day I have to attend to their roll call. They burned a number into my skin. They took photos of me between the barbed wire. All my bones may be counted as in a radiography. They took my personal documents. They pushed me naked into the gas chamber and divided my clothes among themselves. And to close with the note of hope, because I think that's very important. Laments cannot stand on their own. Here you feel with this psalm made by a man to be executed the following day in the form of a letter to his son, you see how hope is overcoming even death. Tomorrow, my son, everything will be different. Oppression will vanish through the back door, which will be closed forever by the hands of new persons. Small farmers will laugh on their sides. They will be tiny, but they will be their own. The workers' daughters no longer need to prostitute themselves, nor the daughters of the farmer. They will work in dignity and earn their food and clothes. Weeping will cease in the house of the poor. You will laugh with joy, and your laughter will be carried away by roads and streams and lanes. So far, our first session.
Thank you.